Ms. Chen.
May it please the court, my name is Alice Chen. I represent appellants, the Carpenters. I will refer to appellees collectively as the Plasterers. The Carpenters appealed the district court's decision to affirm two arbitration awards giving construction work to employees represented by the Plasterers on two different school projects.
Louder.
I'm sorry. By employees represented by the Plasterers for two different school projects for the Los Angeles Unified School District. The arbitration decisions flow from a Section 8F pre-hire agreement embodied by the LAUSD's Project Stabilization Agreement. The arbitration decisions directly conflict with the NLRB certification orders for the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters and prohibit Jordan Interiors and Fry Construction, the employers in this these matters.
So under your theory of this case, how could there be any longer any pre-hire agreements? How could they happen?
The pre-hire agreement.
Under your theory, if you're right that the representational election trumps the pre-hire agreement, that's your theory, right? Then we even though Congress has approved these agreements and the courts have endorsed them, there really couldn't be any if the local union is represented by a union, right?
Our theory in this case is that upholding the district court's decisions here, specifically in these appeals, would abrogate the Section 7 rights of Jordan.
Yeah, but that's my question. If the under the agreement has a provision in it which says that it controls a right for all project hiring, not for hiring beyond the project, but for all project hiring. That's the way the 8F agreement works. So if you're right that this election trumps that, then how could there be these pre-hire agreements?
The pre-hire agreements can continue to exist so long as there are no elections by workers that say that the workers are to be represented by a certain union. Here, the Southwest Regional.
So then it no longer trumps, the agreement no longer trumps everything else, right? It doesn't control.
It doesn't.
But that is your theory. So anytime a union, anytime there's a union election, the agreement no longer controls. Is that the way it works?
Well, as between.
That's the consequences of your argument, correct?
In these appeals, yes.
Why not?
But wouldn't that be everywhere? I don't understand why that wouldn't apply everywhere.
In this appeal,
I don't understand how there could be these agreements any longer.
These agreements can continue to exist if they're, unlike in this case, there is a wall-to-wall certification of employees for all the construction work for the Jordan Interiors and Fry Construction employers.
So the certifications changed, right? So that You put in place a system for the steady erosion of the 8F agreement, right?
Well, under 8F, there is a provision that allows the employees to have an escape hatch to contest a union's majority status at any time during the terms of a bargaining agreement by filing an election petition. So here, when the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters was elected.
That could coincide with the agreement prevailing in all cases, right?
Yes.
Might be a shift of workers from one place to another.
Correct.
So whereas what you're asking for would not allow the agreement, at least in terms of supervision over the jurisdiction of work, to continue. Continue uneroded.
What we're asking for is here because there has been a certification of wall-to-wall construction work for both Jordan and Fry because the arbitration awards require that the work be done by employees represented by the plasterers, that is a representation issue that conflicts with the NLRB election certifications that certify the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters as the exclusive representative of the employees for both groups of employers.
Can I ask you, the website for the Los Angeles School District says that both these projects ended in 2011. Is that correct? If so, why is this not moved?
They have ended in 2011, to the best of my knowledge. It's not moot because there may be other jobs until 2013. The LAUSD agreement has been extended to 2013. If the lower court's decision were allowed to stand, and the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters and the Plasterers Local 200 had signed the LAUSD agreement 10 years ago in May 2003, and the operative facts for Jordan took place in 2009, where the employees voted the NLRB voted in an NLRB election certifying the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters as their exclusive representative in June 2009, and then Jordan signed the letter of assent in October 2009. In Frye, the operative events took place in 2011. If the lower court's decision were allowed to stand, even new employees are contractually deprived of their Section 8 of election remedies.
I'm sorry, why do you say they're deprived? The national union signed on to the agreement, right?
Yes, but...
And isn't the local bound by that? I mean, isn't that what this case is all about? You have a national union that signed on, and that bound its locals.
Actually,
I'm sorry. Is that not true?
The local, the international union is not signatory. The local unions, I believe, are signatory. And as you wrote in Nova Plumbing, by focusing exclusively on employer and union intent, the fundamental obligation to protect employees' Section 7 rights will have been neglected.
I'm not asking you about the question of intent. I agree with that. But it's a question of who signed the contracts and the consequences of those signings.
Well, the local union signed 10 years ago, well before the 2009 and 2011 certification of the union by the employees. So temporally, you have an arrangement where a local union can sign on well in advance of any certification, and the employees are stuck with the pre-hire agreement no matter what the local union or employer intends.
It seemed to me that the crux of the district court opinion was that jurisdictional and representational issues are completely distinct. There's a factual overlap, which is really the center of your claim, but conceptually they're completely different. And I didn't see a real response to that in your brief.
There is a big overlap, and in this case,
an overlap in the sense that in this case, your brief argues that the workers for Jordan Frye won't be able to do this work. Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So that, which is a jurisdictional proposition.
They won't be able to do this work because they're being punished for voting the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters as their exclusive representative.
Punished. They can't do the work because they lost the jurisdictional dispute before the arbitrator.
Well, they can't do this work. The plasterers are arguing that only employees represented by them can do this work. And I know the plasterers have been trying to frame this as a jurisdictional issue, but in Frye, we included evidence where the plasterers was attempting to get Frye to recognize them, even though they try to disclaim all recognition, and this evidence is
not. I don't see that how that helps us on the proposition that jurisdiction and representation are conceptually completely discrete issues.
One of the main cases that the Plasterers relied on a lot was Carey, and in Carey, even the court acknowledged that it's a blurry line, and if it is a representational issue, it's a representational issue because you would have
which a situation. There's a consequence for the representational choice of the Fry and Jordan employees. Right.
Right.
But basically, what the arbitrator did was decide a jurisdictional dispute, period.
There are
with consequences for Jordan's and Fry's workers.
Right, and the consequences are representational in nature.
Well, I thought your argument was that they're not only representational, they're in terms of what work they can do, but that follows from the jurisdictional award.
Yes. I'm not sure I completely understand where.
Well, I'm just trying to suggest that if jurisdiction and representation are conceptually completely discrete, then there's a factual problem for Jordan and Fry and for their workers, who were represented by one union. There's not a legal conflict.
The lines here are blurred. It is a representational issue because clearly the Section 8 of pre-hire agreement and Section 3.1 of the LAUSD agreement indicates that the contractors to the LAUSD agreement have to recognize the unions. And since we have this election certification recognizing the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters, the employer, employers Jordan and Fry would have no choice but to recognize the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters.
Can you, just two quick questions. One is, can you explain your collateral estoppel argument to me? Aren't you arguing that the court's collaterally estopped by a judgment he changed? He revoked?
Yes.
How can collateral estoppel work under that situation?
For collateral estoppel, what happened was the lower court, I believe, issued its initial decision in favor of the Carpenters back in September 2010. Fry occurred in 2011 because of the mistake or a fact that the Plasterers should have brought to the attention to the court well before 2011. We relied on the decision in Jordan for the Fry case, which occurred in 2011. And so because of that, we argued the court was collaterally estopped from reversing its former decision, or at least not.
Do you have any case law for that at all, where we would find a court collaterally stopped from considering an issue based on a decision that the court itself altered?
Not offhand,
but I don't think so. You also rely on California Code 4107, right?
Yes.
But it refers to prime contractors. And isn't Fry a subcontractor?
I believe the subcontracting law indicates that as a subcontractor also, you would have to fulfill a number of the other requirements that we argued cannot be met here.
And where does it say that?
I don't have
this
site on. Let me find it. Really?
Ms. Chen, why don't you, your time is expiring, why don't you look for it and we'll let you get, have a couple of minutes and reply.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Bullock. Can I ask you about the mootness issue? Ms. Chen said there were some jobs left. Has Project 11 and Project 7, have they ended?
I don't have any personal knowledge as to the status of the projects. If the website says the projects are completed, they may be completed. I don't believe that the dispute in this case is moot because we have an outstanding issue of the appellants not refusing to comply with the Los Angeles Unified School District Project Stabilization Agreement and refusing to acknowledge
and
their
other
obligations.
Projects?
I'm sorry?
In other projects or when?
Where well, in these projects right now.
So they're not finished?
Well, I don't know the status of the projects.
Okay.
Didn't you just say that if the website says they're finished, they're finished?
Well, I would assume that...
But suppose they are. Just assume, hypothetically, that they're finished.
If they're finished, the question is there still a justiciable controversy in this case?
That's what Judge Henderson asked you?
Yes, there is still a justiciable controversy.
Because?
In this case. Because what we have right now is what was originally a dispute over the assignment of work. And the carpenters refused, the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America refused to comply with that provision, with that award. And the plasters want the district court to enforce that award. The enforcement of the award,
damages? Or back pay or anything?
There are no damages under the plan.
Are you invoking the concept of capable of repetition yet evading review?
Well, we still have projects, as Ms. Chen noted, the agreement is still in effect. The Los Angeles Unified School District.
The what is still in effect? The what?
The Los Angeles
Unified. Oh, the plan is still in effect.
Yeah, the plan is still in effect. The project stabilization agreement is still in effect. It covers over 1,000 schools and office buildings, the construction and major rehabilitation of those buildings. There is the possibility that additional disputes may arise because as contractors come on and get awards, under the project stabilization agreement, they have the right to assign the work, but signatory unions have the right to challenge that work if the award does not comply with Article 8, Section 8.1 of the stabilization agreement, which requires assignments to be in accordance with the plan.
And how about the fact, or am I right about this, that the carpenters are no longer in the AFL-CIO? How does that affect it?
It doesn't affect it because
okay,
the way the plan works is that for unions and employers to come before the plan, they have to be what they call stipulated.
Right.
And a way to be stipulated is to have a plan and an agreement. So you have a Los Angeles Unified School District Project Stabilization Agreement, Article 8, Section 8.2 has a provision that says that all jurisdictional disputes shall be submitted to the plan for resolution and that all parties, contractors, and unions shall be bound to any resolution by the plan. That satisfies the requirement to appear before the plan. So even though the carpenters are not members of the AFL-CIO, they are still bound to the plan by virtue of the project stabilization agreement. Now, the way the plan works.
If they stipulate, I thought once they got out of the... I thought that's what put them in this plan was their membership in the AFL-CIO. They can stipulate. That's another way to do it, and that's
yes.
Voluntarily. But that's not.
Yes, because
what
we have
they did
because,
in this case.
Because with the project, because with an undertaking of this size, you have a lot of different contractors, you have a lot of different unions. So, and not all of them may have unions that have who are affiliates of the AFL-CIO. Recognizing that, you have a means by which the collective bargaining agreement itself to allow for those sort of non-affiliated parties to come before the plan. Now, I'm happy to answer questions. I sort of came with three points that I wanted to...
Look, I do have a question.
Sure.
That is, if we accept the district court's reasoning on the difference between jurisdiction and representation, does the sequence of the certification and the joining of the plan by Jordan and Fry, does that have any consequence?
It doesn't. And here's the reason why. And this was mentioned in the Supreme Court's decision in Cary, and it's based upon a longstanding rule of the National Labor Relations Board, the agency that issues these certifications in the first instance. The board has recognized, and in the case of the Plumbing Contractors Association of Maryland, it's 93 NLRB 1081 in 1951, they recognized that a certification only covers the people. It doesn't cover the work. Specifically, I want to quote the board, a board certification in a representation proceeding is not a jurisdictional award. It is merely a determination that a majority of employees in an appropriate unit have selected a particular labor organization for collective bargaining purposes. The board went on to say, unlike a jurisdictional award, this determination by the board does not freeze the duties or work tasks of employees found appropriate. Thus, the board's unit finding does not preclude an employer from adding to or subtracting from employees' work assignments. So a certification does not include the work. And going to the district court's decision, there's an easy sort of way to determine what a dispute is. If a dispute is over work, it's jurisdictional. If a dispute is over employees, it is representational. The only evidence in this record regarding the dispute are complaints filed by the operative plasters and cement masons with the plan. Those complaints specifically identify the work in dispute. That work in dispute being the plastering work that Jordan and Fry did on two construction projects covered by the Los Angeles Unified School District.
And if we agree with you on that, then the 60B1 issue disappears, does it not?
I'm sorry, can you please repeat that?
If we agree with you on that proposition, then the 60B1 issue disappears.
It would, yes. There's a more fundamental principle at issue here, and it involves these jurisdictional disputes. The appellant spent a lot of time talking about Section 9 and about Section 7 and the rights of employees. But there are also fundamental labor policies that address the resolution of jurisdictional disputes. Congress recognized back in the 1940s that jurisdictional disputes often give rise to strikes, picketing, work stoppages, stuff that impacts employers and the ability to perform work. That's why they passed Section 10K of the National Labor Relations Act. That section created an alternative procedure by which disputes could be resolved before the National Labor Relations Board. However, the board can't get to every procedure. In order for the board to assume jurisdiction over a procedure, an unfair labor practice charge has to be filed that alleges that someone violated the act, one of the unions violated the act. Not every jurisdictional dispute involves a violation of the act. These didn't. That's why Congress, when it passed Section 10K, also specifically endorsed the resolution of jurisdictional disputes through private procedures, such as the plan. And it endorsed them to such a point that it even stripped the board of its jurisdiction in cases where there was satisfactory evidence that all the parties, the unions and the employers, are bound to that private dispute resolution procedure. So the board couldn't even hear that procedure in that instance. It has to be resolved through that private resolution procedure. And that's what happened in this case. All of the parties were bound to the Los Angeles Unified School District agreement. There's no dispute that the carpenters were bound, the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters were bound. There's no dispute that Plasters Local 200 was bound. They both signed the agreement in 2003 and for 10 years have enjoyed the benefits of that agreement. There's also no dispute that when Jordan and Fry executed letters of assent, they bound themselves to the agreement, all terms of the agreement, including Article 8, Section 8.1, which requires that work assignments be signed in accordance with the plan, and Article 8, Section 8.2, which says that all disputes over work assignments, all jurisdictional disputes, shall be resolved in accordance with the plan. So when these disputes arose, the operative plasters and cement masons followed the agreement. We filed complaints with the plan. Those complaints went to arbitrators. The arbitrators applied the criteria of the plan, and they issued their awards. The district court enforced those awards, and furthering the National Labor Relations policy. And at this point, we're reached a situation where the appellants, after having enjoyed the benefits of this agreement for 10 years, are now trying to evade this agreement at the moment when the obligations come due. And they're hiding behind the certification, even though for law for the past 50 years has said that a certification doesn't cover work, that work can be removed from a bargaining unit without affecting employee Section 7 rights or Section 9 rights, without any evidence that we've attempted to, that any evidence that the Plasters have ever sought to represent any employee of Jordan and Fry. And in that regard, the evidence that Ms. Chen referred to were agreements not seeking recognition, but agreements in an effort to implement the arbitrator's award.
Actually, to some extent, your position turns on the proposition that if the appellant's view prevailed, the plan would unravel. Could you just depict how the plan would unravel under that scenario and how fast?
It could happen actually fairly fast, because Section 9A rights aren't dependent on a board certification. An employer and a union can get together and, through voluntary recognition, establish a 9A relationship. So they could, for the carpenters, sit 10 years, and at the point at which they fear that they're not going to get the benefit of the agreement, they can file a petition for representation. They can get a voluntary recognition, and through the carpenter's argument, vitiate the agreement. And they basically are setting forth the process for doing that. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did.
And that also runs counter to another policy, and that is holding parties to the agreements that they signed. The courts have recognized, and in particular in the amicus brief, we cite the Jim McNeff versus Todd, that once you've signed an agreement, you are bound to its both the benefits and the obligations of that agreement. Finally, I think it's important to remember also that there's also a third set of fundamental labor policies at issue, and that's just the general policies supporting arbitration. Since the Supreme Court's Steelworkers Trilogy, in one of the cases we cite, the United Steelworkers of America versus the Warrior Gulf and Navigation Company, recognize that arbitration is an important part of the labor management relations in this country.
But we still, we it's a very deferential review of decisions, but still errors of law, right? Or basis for...
If an arbitrator's decision violated a specific law,
right.
Yes.
I mean, the standard says if it's repugnant, right?
Repugnant, yes.
But that means, that doesn't mean anything different than it violates, does it? Does that mean it has to really, really violate it, or is just violating it enough?
Well, I don't think it necessarily has to really, really violate a statute. I don't think we're drawing those type of conclusions. If
you're
an arbitrator's award violates
the
statute, then it could be set aside.
Yeah.
But the arbitrator awards here don't violate the statute. They don't violate Section 9.
I understand your argument.
At all.
At all.
At all.
Period. Right. Yeah. Okay.
So I realize I still have a few more minute and a half. If there's any other further questions.
You don't have to take it.
Okay. What I want to do is just close by saying that the appellee in this case, and 7161 and 7155 respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision enforcing the arbitration awards. And I thank you for your time and consideration of this case.
Thank you. Yeah. Ms. Chen, do you have any? She doesn't have any. Why don't you take a couple of minutes, and you were looking for something.
To answer the earlier question about the Subcontracting Act, Section 4107B of the California Public Contract Act says that in addition to the requirements in Section B, there has to be 9 other criteria that the subcontractor would have to meet in order to get a substitution of a subcontractor in place. But to distinguish a couple of cases that appellee brought up. First, Plumbing Contractors was decided in 1951, well before Section 8F even came into existence in 1959. Plumbing contractors merely stands for the proposition that as between two lawfully recognized unions under a valid collective bargaining agreement, the unit certification will not decide the jurisdictional dispute. In plumbing contractors, the board considered only the limited question of whether a single proposed craft unit of employees was appropriate. It did not address a wall-to-wall unit. And then I wanted to distinguish Cary. Cary also did not involve a pre-hire agreement as in this case. In Cary, there were two certified craft unions. Here there is only one certified one certified wall-to-wall unit, the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Cary also established the supremacy of the board's decisions and orders, like the certification orders here. So whenever a board order conflicts with contractual rights, the board order and the statutory rights should trump the contractual rights. I would like to conclude by asking the court to vacate the lower court's decision and overturn the arbitration decision. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Give us a minute.